We'll call this meeting of the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee to order for today, February 21st, 2023. Representative Mecklen, you looked at the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and it does even note our little kerfuffle last week and with the correction, so I would move the minutes.
Representative Mecklen moves the minutes from February 16th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Meetings are approved. Minutes are approved. Anyway, our first bill on the agenda today is Representative Kraft, House File 772. I'll make the motion that this is going to Ways and Means. I'll move House File 772 to be re-referred to Ways and Means. And I believe you had a last minute two amendments.
I have an author's amendment and then a last minute amendment, yeah.
Okay. Which one is the author's amendment?
The author's amendment is A6.
A6, okay, I see. There's, I got three amendments here.
I believe
so A6 amendment is the author's amendment. Do you want to kind of explain what that does?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It gets it in gets it up as I would like to have it heard, and it's also the result of a bunch of stakeholder engagement since our last committee hearing in climate and energy. And I'll go into
sounds good. I'll move the A6 amendment. All in favor to put the bill in the order the author wishes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion of the amendments approved. There are two other amendments I have here, an A7 and an A8. Okay, I'll do the A8 first because that's the author's amendment. And what does this one do? I'll move the A8 amendment. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is as a result of some feedback from some utility partners here. And they just wanted it to be clear that some of their conservation improvement programs are tied to the energy code. And so they just want clarification that nothing we're doing impacts their ability to run these types of programs. And so I've talked with them and I've talked with stakeholders and everyone was okay with it.
Okay, any questions of this amendment? If not, all in favor of the A8 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. And then we have the A7 amendment. Representative Mecklen, I understand that's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this last October, my furnace went out, and I didn't have one for about 5 days. And it was cold. And luckily, I had two gas fireplaces that kept our house warm. If we didn't have those gas fireplaces, we'd have no source of heat. What this amendment does is it prohibits the local municipalities from prohibiting the use of natural gas or propane or running into the new construction or even in substantial remodels. It to me, it's very, very important we have all the above approach. I mean, we constantly hear about diversity, inclusion, and equity. We need it in our energy forms as well. This is very, very important, and I hope you would accept this as a friendly amendment.
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mecklen, thank you for the amendment. There's nothing in this bill that's about local government. There's also nothing in this bill that's about fuel source. And so with that, I ask a no vote.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been coming up for the last several years. I've had a very similar amendment to this in energy, I don't know how many times. But we are very concerned about the direction where this is going long term. And even if you read one of your amendments, it's talking about 80% by, 2036. There are certain limitations of just life in general. If you're saying there's nothing in this bill that is going that direction, then how could this amendment possibly hurt it?
Representative Mecklen, any other comments on Representative Mecklen? Representative Kraft. I'm looking at, Mecklen, Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Representative Mecklen wants to offer a bill around that, that's fine. It's just, this is not about fuel source in any way, and my testifiers will talk about how this energy efficiency is very much achievable in the time frame that we've talked about, regardless of fuel source. So again, I urge a no vote.
Any other comments on the, Representative Mecklen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as I read this, it's, you know, it's about energy efficiency and building codes going forward and requirements. I do see this as very much the direction where this is trying to take it, and that is the whole point of the A7 amendment. But you've already stated you recommend a no vote, so I guess that'll be the outcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So all in favor of the A7 amendment, please say aye.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call.
Roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
No.
Nelson, nay. Vice Chair Berg?
No.
Berg, nay. Lead McDonald?
Yes, yay.
McDonald, aye. Representative Daniels?
Aye.
Daniels, aye. Representative Greenman?
No.
Greenman, nay. Representative Hill?
No.
Hill, nay. Representative Hussein?
No.
Hussein, nay. Representative Jordan?
Jordan, no.
Jordan, nay. Representative Kozlowski?
No.
Kozlowski, nay. Representative Meckland?
Aye.
Meckland, aye. Representative Myers?
Aye.
Myers, aye. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott?
No.
Wolgamott, nay. Mr. Chair, the conclusion of roll call, there are 5 ayes and 8 nays.
With 5 ayes and 8 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Now to the bill. Representative Kraft, if you want to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to start by providing some context for this bill. In 2007, we in Minnesota adopted the Bipartisan Next Generation Energy Act, which, among other things, set a goal to reduce statewide greenhouse gas emissions 80% by 2050. Now, science indicates that in order to avoid the worst consequences of climate change, we should be aiming for actually net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, which is the goal of Minnesota's climate action framework. In Minnesota, buildings account for 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions, with commercial buildings almost half that amount. In my own community of St. Louis Park, buildings are about 60% of our emissions, and two-thirds of that amount comes from commercial buildings. So with that, I'm very happy to be bringing House File 772 on commercial building energy codes to this committee today. This bill focuses on an important part of this sector, new commercial buildings, and setting a path for them to be highly energy efficient and thereby reducing their energy usage and, as a result, their greenhouse gas emissions. First, some more background. So commercial buildings in this are any non-residential building and any multifamily building 4 stories or greater. We talk about the State Building Code. It's a collection of state laws and rules that apply a uniform set of standards to the construction and modification of buildings in order to enhance safety, energy efficiency, and accessibility. The Department of Labor and Industry is responsible for maintaining our state building codes, which includes the energy code for residential and commercial buildings. The department already updates these codes regularly, achieving additional energy efficiency with each update. The approach taken in this bill is the thoughtful result of stakeholder collaboration, and you can see that in the testifiers and the letters of support received, that has been going on for years, including a report released jointly by the Department of Labor and Industry and the Department of Commerce in December of 2020. A key stakeholder is our cities, some of which have climate plans, which means that the need for better buildings with respect to energy efficiency and performance is something that many of our cities have been seeking for years. It's time for the state to act, and with House File 772, we can do so in a way that is fully consistent with our established statewide code adoption process. This bill does not expand or alter the scope of which elements of a commercial building are covered by the code. HF 772 simply accelerates the existing established process for updating the commercial energy code while providing a measure of certainty for the department and our commercial building industry. It acknowledges that to reduce emissions, it's best to make a building as energy efficient as possible. The bill puts the energy code on the path so that by 2036, buildings will be highly energy efficient, 80% more efficient than the 2004 code. This transition in buildings is coming. What we're doing here is providing certainty for developers, electricians, contractors, and those businesses who create products for buildings, while also charting a path to hit our climate goals. Certainty is good for jobs, it's good for our economy, and it's good for our environment. And along the way, we'll be seeing better, healthier, more comfortable, and more cost-effective buildings. Now, a couple notes about this bill. There's two sections that are in it, Section D and E. Section D is basically clarifying that climate impacts are among the reasons that Department of Labor and Industry may adopt amendments to energy codes, and that the energy codes are about optimizing energy efficiency and improving building resiliency. Section E is where the guidance on commercial energy code resides. With that, I'd like to invite up the testifiers that I have.
And I have a list of testifiers here. The first person on my list is Kate Peruchek from the Department of Labor and Industry. And after that, I've got a Richard Graves, so. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Peruchek and I am Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 772 as amended. Improving building energy efficiency is a key strategy to meet the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals. The bill before you today is a recommendation of the Climate Subcabinet reflected in the Climate Action Framework and is in part the result of a stakeholder work group convened by DLI and the Department of Commerce in the fall of 2019 and spring of 2020. We have been pleased to work with Representative Kraft and stakeholders to continue to refine the legislation. This proposal aligns with and builds upon the department's statutory responsibility to adopt model energy codes and consider amendments to the code to improve the efficiency of a building. The primary goal is to reduce the overall energy consumption of the building sector as the sector continues to grow. The agency follows a robust process of evaluating and adopting model building codes. It includes consulting with the Construction Codes Advisory Council, a group of technical experts representing a variety of interests in the construction industry, and frequently technical advisory groups, where experts and affected stakeholders evaluate codes and recommend amendments specific to Minnesota. The agency evaluates and adopts model energy codes every 3 years and supports this statewide approach to maintain uniformity and minimize complexity. The agency is nearing completion of rulemaking to adopt the latest model commercial energy standard, ASHRAE 90.1-2019. ASHRAE establishes the minimum standards for the efficient use and conservation of energy in new and remodeled commercial buildings. It addresses energy conservation requirements for all aspects of energy use, including heating, ventilation, lighting, water heating, and power usage for appliances and building systems, providing design requirements for all facets of energy conservation. Adopting model and commercial energy codes every 3 years and considering amendments that further increase and optimize energy efficiency will incrementally move towards achieving an 80% reduction in annual net energy consumption compared to a 2004 baseline. DLI will engage a consultant to perform market and cost analysis to determine necessary energy efficiency performance enhancements and will work closely with technical experts and the Construction Codes Advisory Council to develop these standards. Improving energy efficiency and resiliency means better buildings, lower emissions, and a healthier Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to share our support for this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Peruchek. If you want to hang around, if you got questions afterwards. Mr. Graves, and the next person on my list is Simona Fisher. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Graves. I'm director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. And I was the technical expert for the stakeholder work by the Departments of Commerce and Labor and Industry in 2019 and 2020, which came up with a trajectory for the future of the commercial energy code. I'm here to provide information about HF 772 that would revise the state energy code to increase energy efficiency of the built environment in Minnesota. The bill sets a target for the commercial energy code to be 80% better than the 2004 version of the ASHRAE 90.1 energy standard. The next few images should give some information and context about that goal. The slide that I have up shows building performance from a typical building in 2003, which would be a 100 on this scale, all the way to if buildings were net zero, they would be a zero on the zero energy performance scale. So the ASHRAE 90.1 2004 standard is a 73 on the scale, and the current version of the Minnesota Commercial Code that's rolling out would be a 47.5. So what that shows as a bit of context is that current code improvements have improved the commercial energy code over time by more than 50% from where we were in 2003 from a typical building. There's the potential for future prescriptive code and performance code improvements to take us down to sort of the mid-20s on this scale. And then somewhere around 20 to 15, the language in the bill would set a target of a 15 on the zero energy performance index. That takes the target for the commercial energy code into the zone of the limit of cost-effective energy efficiency that all new code versions are analyzed by the Department of Labor and Industry to see that they're on track to be cost-effective. And that would be the limit of the commercial energy code and other strategies to reduce the climate emissions of the built environment would be on the renewable energy side in the red part of this graph. And this last slide shows the stepping down of the commercial energy code over time down through this zero energy performance index. And there would be four or five code revisions between now and 2036. And as the deputy commissioner said, each one of those code revisions would go through a cost effectiveness test to look and see if there were adjustments or other strategies that would be needed to be integrated into the commercial energy code as it progresses towards this goal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Next person on my list is Simona Fisher. After that, we have Kevin Pranis. If you want to hang around if there's questions. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Simona Fisher. I'm an architect and the director of sustainable practice at MSR Design and a member of the American Institute of Architects Minnesota, which represents more than 2,300 members, architecture and design professionals in our state. I'm here today to offer AIA Minnesota's support for HS 772, which would accelerate the adoption cycle for the Commercial Energy Code. AIA Minnesota and its member architects are committed to addressing the significant impact the built environment has on our climate. The built environment accounts for around 40% of carbon emissions and energy use, so making changes here could be the next big impact opportunity to make our state more energy efficient and energy independent. We are also experiencing greater frequency of extreme weather events, which is increasing costs and financial risks for all Minnesotans, including farmers, building owners, local governments, and residents, and it only reinforces the imperative to build and retrofit resilient, high-performing buildings. AIA has been raising the ceiling for high-performance buildings for many years, but most buildings and the budgets for those projects are still designed to meet the floor, which is the energy code. So basically, it is high time to raise that floor. As co-chair of the AIA Minnesota Committee on the Environment, I hear regularly from AIA members across the state how they rely on a strong energy code as foundational to delivering higher performing projects for their clients. And utilizing the most up-to-date energy codes as a state will not only lead to higher performing projects, it will also lay the groundwork for Minnesota projects to maximize the use of new federal incentives and rebates. So there's the potential here for a win-win-win, which is not only in climate and resilience, but also in dollars. The proposed standard would still go through the rigorous Minnesota code adoption process where Minnesota-specific changes are made and stakeholders across the design and construction industry are consulted. The Department of Labor and Industry already administers a thorough and intentional process, and they are more than ready to take on an accelerated pace of review. Numerous AIA Minnesota members have supported the work of codes review and adoption over the years and have seen firsthand that the department's process works for our state. DLI completes a thoughtful, thorough review while moving us forward on a path to greater energy efficiency and a reduction of our carbon footprint. We need to address these very real impacts of the built environment on our changing climate, and these provisions will help us do that. So we urge you to move this bill forward for adoption this session. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Fisher. Kevin Prentice, and next I have Isaac Orr. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Kevin Prentice on behalf of Liuna, Minnesota, and North Dakota. We represent 29,000 members and family members who are skilled construction laborers and public employees working across the state of Minnesota on buildings, energy infrastructure, and civil infrastructure. Our organization supports climate action that makes sense across all of those different areas, whether it's energy production or buildings or transportation. I'm not here as an expert on efficiency. I would certainly refer to IBEW Local 292, the sheet metal workers, crafts that are more directly engaged in installation of the kinds of technologies, as well as glazers and others who install these technologies. I'm here, first of all, to express appreciation for Representative Kraft's hard work with stakeholders to address concerns and make sure that this is a good bill that's broadly supported. To my knowledge, our organization and other trades, as well as other folks who work in the industry. And what I would say about this is we don't know exactly how the state will meet climate goals in the building sector and what mix of electrification and clean fuels will get us the gains that we need. What we do know is that efficiency will play a big part. Efficiency makes everything easier. It produces immediate reductions in cost and reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and it's beneficial no matter what source of energy we're talking about is used in a building. And finally, we have experience achieving significant efficiency gains in new buildings as well as retrofitting existing buildings. This bill, by working within an existing codes framework, relies on the technical expertise, as was mentioned by the Department of Labor and Industry, that technical expertise and stakeholder participation. So we know that this isn't just the legislature making arbitrary decisions about how to build buildings, but instead giving it to the experts to figure that out. The last thing I would say is that I serve on the Governor Walz's Climate Advisory Council, and while I'm not here to speak on behalf of the council, part of our work on the council was interviewing stakeholders, including large construction contractors and companies that produce the kinds of appliances and devices used in buildings. And the feedback we got from those interviews suggested that everyone would really appreciate guidance and a plan about where we're trying to go, what goals we're trying to hit, as well as a process where we can develop information that can be used by all of these construction companies so they don't have to reinvent the wheel. And we believe this process will move that forward, making it easier for everyone across the building sector to successfully reduce costs and reduce emissions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Isaac Orr, the next person I have is Katie Jones. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Isaac Orr, and I'm a policy fellow specializing in energy and environmental policy at Center of the American Experiment. American Experiment greatly appreciates the A6 amendment because it seeks to limit the Department of Labor and Industry's authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions and limits that to increasing and optimizing energy efficiency and improving resiliency of new buildings and existing buildings undergoing additions, alterations, and changes of use. We believe this language is a positive improvement over the current engrossment, and we think there is room for further additional clarification to ensure the legislature is not endowing DLI with the ability to regulate how Minnesota families heat their homes. My concern with this legislation, or with this language, stems from the possibility that the phrase increasing and optimizing energy efficiency could be construed as a way to require the installation of heat pumps or electric resistance heating for home space heating applications and potentially ban natural gas furnaces. So heat pumps are impressive machines because they transfer heat rather than generate it. That allows their effective efficiencies to be 3 to 4 times higher than natural gas furnaces. However, heat pumps are not ready for the job of taking over for gas furnaces in Minnesota winters. In fact, the Mitsubishi H2i, which was Carbon Switch's best-rated cold-weather heat pump in December 2022, shuts off at negative 13 to prevent itself from sustaining damage. Furthermore, these are expensive units. I got a quote yesterday from an installer from my triplex, and the cost of installing one of these would be $31,000 after the electric panel upgrades that I need to go from a 100-amp service to 200-amp service. And the technician told me that my boiler would still be needed when the temperature is below 25 degrees above zero, right? So it's a supplement, not a staple. Therefore, I'm asking that the committee build upon the improvements in the A6 amendment to explicitly clarify that DLI will not have the authority to require certain heating technologies or ban others as part of future updates to Minnesota's building codes. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you for your testimony. Katie Jones, and then the next is Nick Erickson. Welcome to the committee. State your name and proceed.
Hello, Chair Nelson and members of the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify on House File 772. My name is Katie Jones, and I'm the Community Program and Policy Manager at the Center for Energy and Environment, known as CEE. We are a Minnesota-based nonprofit with expertise in energy efficiency that traces back over 40 years. Our mission is to discover and deploy the most effective energy solutions that strengthen the economy and improve the environment. We know that, so I am speaking in support of this amended legislation to advance the state commercial energy code to be 80% more efficient in 2036 compared to the ASHRAE 90.1 2004 model code. We know that the cheapest kilowatt hour is the one that is never used. I'm going to say that again. We know that the cheapest kilowatt hour is the one that is never used. That means that energy efficiency and conservation are the cornerstone for low energy bills. The most cost-effective time to build inefficiency is at construction. Think about it. How often does an owner change a building's orientation or insulation or windows? Given that new buildings stick around for 50, 75, sometimes over 100 years, we have essentially one chance with every build to do this right and to help save Minnesota residents and businesses money on their utility bills going forward. Luckily, Minnesota has a strong foundation for energy efficiency advancement, which helps make this bill feasible. CEE contributes to that progress. We conduct in-the-field energy efficiency research, often with the help of the state's Conservation Applied Research and Development grant program, and by working with the utility programs and city code officials to maximize the energy code. Furthermore, CEE is leading the proposal team, along with the Department of Commerce and the Department of Labor and Industry, among others, in Minnesota's submission for the Federal Resilient and Efficient Codes Implementation Program. This legislation would show that the federal government that Minnesota is serious about advancing commercial codes and making us more competitive for funding. Multiple years of stakeholder engagement, including a process convened by the Department of Commerce as well as Department of Labor and Industry, have culminated in this bill centered around improving efficiency in commercial new construction. And now the new opportunities through the federal IIJA and IRA laws, this bill positions Minnesota to maximize technical efficiency by 2036 in commercial new buildings. This is one of the most impactful and most cost-effective ways the state can enhance the comfort and health of people, make progress towards the state energy goals, and reduce operating costs for building owners. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this legislation.
Thank you for your testimony. Nick Erickson, and then the last person I have on my list is Grace Kelleher. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nick Erickson. I am the Senior Director of Housing Policy for Housing First Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Kraft for listening to our concerns and correspondence over the weekend. Unfortunately, we still have concerns with some of the specific language used in this bill. By way of background, Housing First Minnesota is a statewide trade association made up of members from across the housing industry. Our members are experts in building the communities and homes that we all live in, as well as are driven to increase homeownership opportunities for all Minnesotans. We also operate the state's largest energy-efficient new construction program, Minnesota's Green Path, which to date has tested and rated more than 40,000 new homes in the state. Minnesota is the most energy-efficient, high-production state in the nation, and our homes in our Green Path program are even more energy-efficient than the homes built on average in the state. Specific to the amendment and the bill, I know we've heard that it does not include residential construction, and if that is the intent, due to the original statutory language included on the first engrossment in line 216, as well as the plural use of codes on lines 1.3, does bring residential codes into this discussion. Five decades ago, this body formed the state's building codes on the principles of safety, durability, and affordability. By expanding this into the residential aspect, we are taking us one step further away from those principles. New homes in Minnesota are among the most energy efficient in the nation. Our new homes are not the problem. They are the solution to the state's energy problem. And if housing costs are too high, new homes won't be built, and that is not any way to address our climate discussions. So if the intent is to not include residential into this discussion, I would respectfully request that we do get some clarification, because as presented with the A6, it does include residential. That wraps up my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Ms. Keller. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. I work for the Minnesota Association of Builders, and we represent builders across the state. If you want to think of them, they're more of your small builders that go out. And as we read this section, we have concerns about residential building codes. To start with, I brought with me a field guide of what the codes look like. I just want you to take away from this that the codes that builders have to follow aren't just one or two or three or four or five pages they have to do, but it's a whole manual, and it changes yearly. So they need time to integrate this going forward. The present process done by Dolly is very efficient and very thoughtful going forward, but by putting these changes under the commissioner's authority, there is no guarantee that the processes that work so well now, bringing people in, Dolly training people, sending out guides with information, will occur in the future. So as we look at the new language, and I agree with Mr. Erickson, that especially talking about residential in 2.16, it's pretty clear as you go down that we are impacted. And by saying undergoing additions, alterations, or changes of use, alterations, would that be changing a furnace filter? What exactly would an alteration include that I would then have to implement these energy codes going forward? And truly in Minnesota, we've been blessed. We've had strong commissioners at Dolly who've done the right thing and moved forward. But I want you to consider what happens if maybe we didn't have a great commissioner, if maybe that person had their own agenda going forward. Do you want some legislative review over this? Do you believe the governor needs review over this? We feel it's important that there be checks and balances on this system, and to protect the integrity of the building code, which is 50 years old this year. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to work with Representative Kraft. We would love to see residential pulled out and let the Construction Codes Advisory Council work with the commissioner and Dolly. It's such a strong process going forward. We think that really has merit. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions going forward.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. I've got people on the list here for questions, and I just want to say, I guess my father was a way ahead of his time, because back in the early 60s, he insulated his attic to the point where Minnegasco came out every couple of years because his meter wasn't reading like everybody else's, and because he had insulated his house and saving money on gas. So I also worked with a carpenter who was very proud of when he was in the 50s building houses, and they had this foam insulation that they put on the outside of the studs before the put the sheathing on, and it's sort of the material like you get in those foam packing packages you do to have nowadays. So it was just a thin bubble foam wrapper that he put around there, and he thought he was doing such a great job of insulating houses back then. And this, and when I worked with him, it was 20 years later, and he realized how foolish that was back then. So we've come a long way in energy codes since then. But questions or comments? I got Representative McDonald. Do you want to be first or last?
First, second, and third.
Representative McDonald, do you have a question?
I'll just start out with this. Just a question for Ms. Bruce at Labor and Industry. And maybe you would know this, Representative Kraft, regarding natural gas. I know many folks in my district in Main Street, Minnesota, particularly the older buildings. I own a 100-year-old historic building with 15-foot tall ceilings. Many fans to push the heat down so I can save energy and monies, which is always a good thing, and most business folks do, and building owners. But my building, many of my constituents' buildings on Main Street are heated by natural gas. So in attaining your goal, by 2036, would we have to get rid of heating buildings with natural gas? Do you know that, or the commissioner?
Representative Kraft, Ms. Peruchik.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. No.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McDonald.
I meant to add in there, for the Labor Department of Labor, Kate, through rulemaking, because that is a possibility. On your bill, it would allow the Dolly to initiate that through rulemaking, so that would be more specific.
Ms. Peruchik.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, it would go through the Construction Codes Advisory Council, but I would draw your attention to line 1.20 to 1.22 of the first engrossment. So to the extent possible, the code must be adopted in terms of desired results instead of the means of achieving those results, avoiding wherever possible the incorporation of specifications of particular methods or materials. So to back up Representative Kraft, no, we wouldn't be regulating natural gas use.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Donald.
Then Mr. Representative Kraft, in regards to the American National Standards Institute, they recently adopted over 100 changes, and in your bill, we will, it states that the commissioner shall adopt all of those changes through American Institute of Standards Institute. So should they adopt that, then in your bill, the Department of Labor would have to adopt that as well.
Representative Kraft.
I might ask for some assistance on that from either the Deputy Commissioner or from Richard Graves.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the department doesn't wholesale adopt the model codes as is, which is why we have the Construction Codes Advisory Council and technical advisory groups. They take a real careful study of all the model codes because there are certainly sometimes changes that aren't appropriate for Minnesota's climate. So frequently we do adopt amendments to the model codes to ensure that they work for Minnesota.
And Ms. Bruchik, I understand. I remember a discussion a few years back. In the model code for nationwide, they allow hot water heaters to be in the garage. I don't think that would work in Minnesota. And that's why I think they, is what you said, they look at it and what fits and doesn't fit for us. Representative McDonald, one more question, then I'm gonna go to the others on the list and we can come back to you.
Very good, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, just through rulemaking though, nothing in this bill would have you, through rulemaking, adopt ASHRAE's regulations and their requirements. So because on Kraft's bill, it says, beginning in 2024, the commissioner shall act on the new model commercial energy code by adopting each new published edition of ASHRAE 90.1, or more efficient, more energy efficient standards. So his bill would force you to adopt each new energy standard.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, allow me to clarify. So if the U.S. Department of Energy has issued an affirmative determination that the new model code is more efficient than the prior code, then states are required to act on the model code. However, as I said previously, we don't adopt it wholesale. We adopt amendments to the code to ensure that it's suitable for the state of Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Chair, one follow-up, and then I'll defer.
Okay, Representative McDonald, one follow-up.
Speak until the end if I get this question answered. Then. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kraft, in the producing and building of a building, there's no way to make it carbon neutral at all. You know, pouring concrete alone and all the digging the ground, the excavating, is that part of your initiative as well, or is it truly not going to be carbon neutral by 2036? Because simply to construct a building, you're going to have to have those mechanisms to do to build so. So it's almost an unachievable and unrealistic goal, wouldn't you say?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. So in the stakeholder work we've done over the past several weeks on this, we've dug into that, and that's why the focus of this bill is on making energy efficient buildings. Some of the language that was in prior bills is no longer there. It's about how do we achieve energy efficiency 80% relative to the 2004 standards. That's what the bill is.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kraft. This bill grants a great deal of authority and rulemaking authority to the commissioner. Can you confirm for us, because it's been mentioned several times today, that the intent of this legislation is not to impact the residential building code?
Representative Kraft.
Chair, Representative Schultz, so it is not intended to impact the residential energy code. The focus of the language, in especially in Section E, is about updating the commercial energy code.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kraft. I appreciate the answer. I would encourage you, as this continues to make its way through, that you consider the rest of the whole of the language and the statute that we're working with, so that we can better clearly define that for residential users. And then next question is, is it the intent of this bill to ban materials that contribute to climate change?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, this is about energy efficiency. This is not about banning materials, banning fuel source. This is about energy efficiency based on what some of my testifiers had said in view of what is possible, that we should set ourselves on a defined, understood path to get there, and in so doing, we'll provide a level of certainty to the market and to folks working in buildings. So that's what it's about. It's not about the how, it's about the means. I also wanna say that, I believe that you talked about before about a lot of authority being granted here. We're tapping into a process that already exists, right, where that authorities that already exist. I don't believe there's substantial new things that are added here to that process.
One final question, Representative Schultz.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One further question. So is it your intent that there be no future use of gas or oil based upon the updates to the energy code?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, this bill is about energy efficiency. My personal, and if you're asking about my personal intent, is absolutely irrelevant to this. This bill is about energy efficiency. The intent of this bill is about having increasing highly energy efficient buildings that will reduce costs and improve the livability and health of the participants. That's what this bill is about.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kraft, I appreciate your answer, because I believe that that what you just said is something that I fully agree with, but you didn't answer the question as to whether this bill is meant to stop the use of gas or oil through the energy code.
Representative Mecklen, you're the next person on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And members, remember we've got another bill up, and so we need to get to that one also. So Representative Mecklen.
Representative Kraft, are you familiar with SIPS buildings?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mecklen, SIPS buildings?
Yeah, SIPS.
No.
So,
Representative Mecklen, can you explain what those are? Because I'm not familiar with that term either.
If the intent of this bill, thank you, Mr. Chair, is to create energy efficiency, I'm surprised we don't know about that. SIPS is structural integrated insulated building panel. So take a big, thick block of foam, glue OSB on each side, cut out the windows, put all the pieces together. There's a 7,000 square foot home just, what would that be? I don't know, just west of Maple Grove. Their heating bills don't exceed $50 a month, ever. We hear about eliminating CO2 emissions. Well, if you triple paint your windows, you use class 4 shingles so they don't get damaged and thrown in dumps or landfills every 4 or 5 years from hail. If you
take on these like innovative energy products that are out there. I actually worked on one of these SIPs 6-7 years ago. Problem is, I don't think about 80% of the population can afford it. It's pretty expensive. I mean, I don't know if you plan on giving out grants or whatever, rebates or, you know, pick winners and losers in the industry, but you just got done stating that the authority already exists and you're not trying to change it. So what is the point of all of this if they already have the ability to do it? Can you help me understand, Representative Kraft, what the point of this is if they already have that authority and they've been driving us builders there for the last several years? And can you actually – here's a question for you. I know, but this is like – you got to understand all this that goes through my head. I deal with this day in and day out and out in the field, and you seem to want to push something that is virtually very incredible. I mean, anything can be done for the right amount of money. But what is the percentage of a home built in Minnesota? How much more efficient is than anywhere else in the state?
Representative Kraft.
Chair Nelson, Representative Mecklen, there was a lot of comments in there. I'm not sure what the question was, but if it's relative to the type of building material you were talking about, I'm not familiar with those. Those aren't specified in here, just as much as the type of fuel being used isn't specified in here. And if you talk about the costs of this, right? I think that was also something you mentioned. While it's impossible to know the exact situation of future code revisions, in other places implementing these type of building code policies, the experience has ranged from a 1-3% capital cost increase to a 3% capital cost decrease, right? That have implemented these types of things. And it's notable to talk about the decrease, which happened in Pennsylvania in the third year after implementing passive house standards, because it appears that the building industry got accustomed to it, the certainty of the standard, and it became cheaper to build to the new, more energy efficient standard than without it. And I'm only talking about upfront capital costs. On an ongoing basis, there's substantial savings. If you look at ASHRAE 2019 that's being done, the savings on that is estimated to be 4.5 cents per square foot across the state. Over 30 years, about $280 million. And by the way, if you look at the overall net life cycle cost analysis, the present value of those savings is at least 3 times higher than the upfront cost. So, you know, doing it this way, in this fashion, is a process that we know and ensures us to get the most cost-effective outcome and save operators and occupants of buildings.
Representative Mecklen, final question. I've got somebody else on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one of your testifiers talked about the floor needs to be raised. I guess my question to you is how much is too much? I mean, we have a housing shortage, so at what point do we identify that Minnesota has the most strict energy code as it is? And I actually have to bid these things, so I guess how much do you want to raise the floor on that up front, or especially in alterations and remodeling? Because that makes it much more challenging when you're dealing with existing. So how much are you willing to increase the price of new buildings?
I think that was a rhetorical question more than an actual question. Representative Kraft.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Mecklen. So this bill is about getting to an 80% more efficient, energy efficient building by 2036 compared to the 2004 code. I've given you some data on the fact that it does not substantially increase costs and, in fact, decrease operational costs.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative Kraft. I know a couple people here on the Housing Committee, including myself, and it's something we've talked a lot about, you know, the homelessness that we have, the investments that we want to make in, you know, affordable housing throughout Minnesota, you know, metro, greater Minnesota. I'm not going to ask for an oral amendment, but I am going to ask, because we had some testifiers come up, if you'd be willing, you know, like I've worked with other members, to address that piece to make sure that it is very clear that this isn't affecting residential construction. If you would be willing to discuss that for an amendment kind of offline.
Representative Kraft.
Chair Nelson, Representative Myers. So as I've looked at the language and gotten advice from others, it's that it does not. I'm happy to talk to anyone always offline, and so happy to talk to you. But my view of this language is it does not impact residential. I disagree with some of the testifiers.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Chair Nelson.
Representative Myers.
No, yeah. That's all right. Have you spoken with those testifiers? Have you sat down and spoken to them?
Representative Kraft.
Chair Nelson, Representative Myers. So the first contact I received from them was, I believe, either Friday or over the weekend. I responded and haven't had a chance to go much beyond that, beyond initial response.
Okay. Yep. Thank you for that.
So, yes, I responded.
No, and I appreciate that. I just hope that maybe offline we can discuss that to, you know, look at some of the other stakeholders that have concerns, and, you know, we want to make sure that we're fixing the housing crisis and get people to invest, you know, the money to address that issue. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative McDonald, do you want to do a wrap up quickly?
Quickly, Mr. Chair. A question for nonpartisan staff, though. So, Representative Kraft, certainly I think it should be everybody's intention to have an energy efficient building. Try owning a, you know, a 100-year-old building with 20-foot, you know, windows that are 10 feet high and a 15-foot ceiling. It's expensive to heat, so we all benefit from it. And some of your language perhaps is certainly could be attainable, but what we're hearing is, especially for residential, that it would be very costly, and commercial buildings for that matter, very costly to do so. Certainly saving money on your utility bills over the months and years is a good thing. We all agree on that. But the cost of it, what I'm hearing from builders, and actually I worked with some builders, some commercial builders just yesterday, as a matter of fact, they're very concerned of the extra cost that this will put on the building structures. It'll outweigh any savings that they do in their energy. But residential is a very serious issue, especially with housing costs the way it is. If nonpartisan staff could just clarify in the language of the bill that it does not include whatsoever any residential buildings.
Michelle.
Chair and members, it depends what you mean. So if you are talking about buildings that are currently covered by the residential codes, it doesn't affect those. It only affects those who are subject to the model commercial code or to the commercial energy codes. So, and that, as the commissioner has said, that's multifamily buildings, four stories or higher, I believe.
Correct.
Those are already subject to the commercial energy codes and would continue to be subject to commercial energy codes.
Representative McDonald.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So it does indeed affect it, yes. Thank you. Representative Kraft.
Yeah, Chair Nelson, Representative McDonald. No, it does not, unless you're saying residential is four-story multifamily or higher. What said was residential less than four stories multifamily and single family are not impacted by this whatsoever. Correct?
And Representative Dell, I think that what I heard was that those buildings that you're talking about that are currently covered by it would be covered by whether this bill came forward or not. They're not included in what I think we're quibbling about what is residential, and I think that's what we're quibbling about. So, Representative McDonald, one last, and then we get to a vote here.
Mr. Chair, I'll quit quibbling, I guess, so we know what residential is, and it is it definitely will affect the bill. The bill will affect residential future.
Any further questions or comments? If not, I'll renew my motion that House file, the right number, 772, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
The ayes have it. The motion,
thank you,
is approved. Thank you, sir. The next bill we have on the agenda is House File 908, and I see the authors coming down to the table. And I'll move the House File 908. To be before us, and it gets sent to Human Services Finance Committee. And I see we have a DE amendment. Representative Abadji, is that your amendment?
Yes, that is my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Members, I'll move the A or the DE2 amendment to put the bill in the order that the author would like. All in favor of the DE2 amendment, I'm assuming that's going to be the bill then.
That will be the bill, Mr. Chair.
So all in favor of the DE2 amendment to put the
Mr. Chair.
Bill in the author's way, the author wants, Representative Schultz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would the author of the bill please provide for us the differences in this before we vote on it?
Well, if it's going to In the back, can you either quiet down or take your conversations out so we can hear here, please? Thank you. Representative Schultz, she's going to explain the bill. The DE amendment means that there's nothing in the old bill. This is the new bill. So, Representative Schultz, so we'll put the bill, the amendment, the author's amendment on, which is customary and of doing at the beginning. So all in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
DE2 is adopted. Representative Baje, if you want to explain your bill.
Yes.
As it is now in the DE2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. The DE2 amendment, which is now House File 908. So this is a bill that ensures that our workers in nursing homes are providing the best for Minnesotans who live in nursing homes. This is also a bill to help address the staffing shortage crisis we're seeing in nursing homes since the start of the pandemic. Unfortunately, we aren't going to be able to solve that crisis and give our nursing home residents the care they deserve until we address the crisis of compensation for frontline essential workers who keep nursing homes running. This bill aims to do that by creating a nursing home workforce standards board, and this is an idea dating all the way back to the Great Depression. It's getting new life around the country as a way of bringing workers and employers and specific industries along with our regulators to hopefully together work to improve both wages and working conditions for those that are caring for our loved ones. And in the case of nursing homes, that means stabilizing and growing the workforce to meet the needs of the employers, improving resident care, and doing so in a way that supports the state's goals of world-class care for an industry that receives 80% of its funding from the state. This bill would create a 9-member board appointed to staggered terms by the governor as required for a rulemaking body. And those members include 3 employer representatives from industries that I'm sure will testify today, 3 worker representatives along with commissioners or their delegates from 3 agencies. And those agencies are the Department of Health, which is charged with regulating nursing homes, the Department of Human Services that funds nursing homes, and the Department of Labor and Industry, which addresses labor standards. The Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board would be charged with investigating market conditions that would require direct engagement of workers and employers so that the board has the appropriate information it needs to set the minimum standards for wages and working conditions through rulemaking. These rules are meant to be reasonably necessary and appropriate to protect the health and welfare of nursing home workers. The labor standards established by the board would be enforced through the Department of Labor and Industry's existing authority, as well as a private cause of action, which is already modeled directly on the one that we have in place in our Fair Labor Standards Act in Minnesota. The board would also be charged with reviewing the standards it advances at least once every 2 years to ensure that they are up to date. Now, just to be clear, the authority of the board is limited to those conditions that affect workers in the nursing homes. This bill does not have any authority over the standards for resident care. To ensure that workers are aware of the board's process and how to participate, as well as the standards set by the board and their rights, duties, and obligations, should this bill become law, the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board will be required to create a training curriculum to be delivered by worker organizations certified by the board in twice yearly trainings. And employers will have to provide a notice developed by the board to their employees in whatever manner they already use to provide other work-related notices. So finally, this bill ensures that workers are protected from retaliation for exercising their rights under the bill, including participating in board proceedings and trainings. For some context, a similar bill passed the House last year in the HHS omnibus bill, and this year the governor has included this in a similar proposal in his budget. We all know how critical this industry is to hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans, and we also know that this industry is struggling. We have an obligation to provide for the care of our seniors, but unless we address the crisis of wages and working conditions in our nursing homes, we will never have the workforce needed to provide that care. Creating a Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board is a proven way to address that crisis and give these essential workers, who we have spent the last 2 years praising and uplifting because they are doing a really good job, give those workers a voice in helping determine those minimum standards in partnership with the employers and the state. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to testifiers that we have today.
And just quickly, could you explain what Representative Schulte was asking? What are the major differences between your first draft and now the DE amendment?
Sure. So that, you know, I just did a whole walkthrough of the bill, so that explains the whole bill. But in terms of, like, specific differences, I mean, basically we've clarified, you know, where DALI, the Department of Labor and Industry, has their authority. So that's in the first, you know, in Section 2 of the bill. And a lot of the other requests that DALI has given us, we've also updated those in the DE2 amendment. So if you go through, a lot of it is really just clarifying different language, especially around some of the definitions. We've also clarified some language around staffing for the board, how the board votes, what their investigations look like, and how DALI will also be supportive of this board through their staff. And then finally, we've also clarified some language around the duties of the board based on feedback that we've received from the Department of Labor and Industry.
Thank you, Representative Baji. First person I have on my list is Travis Berth. And after that, I have Rosemary Teasy. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Nelson and member of the committee. My name is Travis Berth. I am a server and a cook at Serenity Care Center. I am here on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare in Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents about 50,000 healthcare workers around the state. We work in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. We support the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Bill. I started working at Serenity in December of 2020. I was one of the few to start in the middle of the COVID epidemic, but I guess you could say I was born to work there. My mom worked in assisted living when I was young. I volunteered with her later. She became a cook at Serenity, and I decided to work there. When I got out of the Army, mostly because I didn't have a car, and my mom could drive me to work. I didn't choose Serenity for the pay. I got hired at $12.50 an hour. After two more years, I still only make $14 an hour as a server. That is barely above minimum wage in St. Paul. I qualified as a cook, but I still only make $17 an hour for my cook shifts. It is easy to find safer, less stressful jobs that pay more. I interviewed with an HVAC company that would pay $20 an hour. Unless you give workers in the industry a chance to set better minimum wage, we will never attract the workforce we need. I thought boot camp in the U.S. Army would be the worst experience of my life. Boot camp was not that bad compared to working in a nursing home that does not have enough staff. When I work weekends, we have just two servers for two whole buildings. Together, we have to feed 160 people. We have to get the meals prepared on the tray line. We have to distribute the trays to the dining room. We have to clean all the dishes. We can't do it on time. We are usually 30 minutes to an hour late. By then, the food is cold. Some residents miss meals, completely because they have a medical appointment. Residents get angry and yell at the staff. I don't blame them. We feel miserable for being late. Every day, some coworkers break down and cry. They say, why is that a job where you feel terrible every day? When we get new employees, they almost always quit. Even our long-term staff quit because they can't take it anymore. The short staffing is worse now than it was during the COVID outbreak. I feel like I can take it better than others because I have been in the Army. But what does that say about this industry? Margaret was another cook. She was a longtime friend of my mom. When I started, she took me under her wing. Because of her, I moved up from server to cook. We would try to support each other when the job got tough. But she got too stressed out and couldn't take it anymore. She quit because of understaffing. Without her, my job is even harder, but I don't blame her. I'm thinking about getting another job, too. I am not a policy expert, but I can tell you what it feels like on the floor of a nursing home. We don't get treated with respect. Our managers pay us as little as they can and get away with it. I have had three administrators in 2 years. The problem is not just a lacking of funds. The business press says lots of people are making money from nursing homes. More of that money should go to workers on the floor. To get more money to the workers, you have to give them power to set standards. I am lucky. I have a union. And I get a voice. But too many workers don't have that chance. The bill wouldn't give them a union, but it would give them some say. We know there are good people in management. They face many of the same challenges we do. All we want is a chance to sit down with them and build something that gives our seniors the care they deserve. Please vote yes and support our house.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Next person I have is Rosemary. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And if we can short it down a little bit so we got time to discuss it.
Jean Nelson and the members of committee, my name is Rosemary Tisi. I live in Mountsville. I have worked at the Estes of Friedrich Nursing Home for 14 years. I am a trained medication aide. I am a member of SEIU Medicare Minnesota and Ohio. When people come to work at our nursing home, they ask, how come you work here? New employees say, this job is really hard. You don't make any money. Then they quit. They get an easy job and any more money. That makes the old employees think they should quit too. It makes me think about quitting. When I started, there were three people to do the job, but we kept losing staff. Then coped it. Now I often have to do the whole job just myself. My job is to give people their medicine. They need to get their medicine on time. But with just one person, I cannot do it on time. I want the medicine won't work as well. Worse, I get interrupted because we don't have other staff. I see residents who are in trouble or about to fall. I have to stop giving medicine to help them. Then I am further behind. Sometimes I can't stop, and they get hurt. If you want more people to work at the nursing home, you need to pay them more money. I have worked for a long time. I have extra training, but I only make $18 as a TMA. Before COVID, I have worked for years without a raise. I don't make enough to feed my family. I have two daughters, one 6 years old and one 4 years old. I want to make enough money so that I can fix my car. I need my car to get to work. But they do not pay me enough to keep my car running. I want an easier life and a chance to be happy. Managers always make us fight for more money. If we did not have a union, they could not pay us more. Workers need more power. We need to make them pay us more. Please, for the years, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Jessica Gross. And after that, I have Toby Pearson. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Gross, and I am the Director of Labor Standards and Apprenticeship at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. I'm pleased to testify in support of House File 908, establishing a nursing home workforce standards board. The governor recommends establishing a nursing home workforce standards board that is responsible for setting minimum employment standards to protect the health and welfare of nursing home workers in the state. Minnesota nursing home facilities provide vital care to some of our most vulnerable citizens. Ensuring nursing home workers have a voice in the terms and conditions of their employment through worker participation in a nursing home workforce standards board alongside employer and agency representatives would improve job quality and worker retention and better support vulnerable Minnesotans. The board would adopt rules to establish minimum employment standards that are reasonably necessary and appropriate to protect the health and welfare of nursing home workers and to ensure workers are properly trained about and fully informed of their rights. The Department of Labor and Industry would have authority to investigate violations and enforce compliance with the Act as well as minimum nursing home employment standards established by the board. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this legislation.
Thank you. Next person, Toby Pearson, and then Aaron Hupert is after that. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Toby Pearson. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota. Speaking today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, I will be joined by my colleague, Ms. Hupert, who will do the second half of our testimony.
She wants to come down right if you're together.
I don't know if she wants to sit that close to me.
She's coming down.
Oh, all right. First, I'd like to thank the author for meeting us to begin discussions around the proposal. We met for 30 minutes last Friday and have another meeting scheduled tomorrow evening to continue our discussions. The proposal has vast reach and technical implications, so we appreciate the author making the time to discuss many of our concerns with us. That being said, we still have to testify about our concerns with the bill in its current form. Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board has been described as a training bill or an attempt to improve wages and staffing at our nursing homes. However, it does nothing to accomplish the most fundamental component needed to make these improvements. That's increased funding for nursing homes. That's contained in House File 733. Appreciate any and all of your support for that file. Census restrictions, the extended duration of pandemic-related expenses, workforce wage competition for many sectors have created significant operational gaps with more expenses paid out than funds coming in. Nearly 50% of the nursing homes have increased wages by more than 10% in the last 2 years, but those costs are not reflected in our current rates. There's an 18-month lag from when we spend a dollar to when we get a dollar back. Doesn't count for inflation. Facilities have also spent thousands of dollars on PPE testing and other pandemic safety improvements, which again, they have not been repaid under the state's current payment system for nursing homes. To address our caregiver shortage, nursing homes need permanent funding from the legislature. Put a bit of a finer point on it, long-term care is currently down 20% of our workforce. Minnesota has an access problem. You've heard about hospital backups. You've heard about denials of admissions from the community. In fact, last fall, we had over 11,000 denials of admissions of individuals seeking placement in nursing facilities. Nursing homes have closed or laid away over 2,400 beds in the past 2 years. That's the equivalent of 48 medium-sized, about 50-bed facilities have closed. The main reason for these is a lack of workforce. Bottom line, nursing homes need more funding so we can raise wages. We have various concerns regarding this proposal. Some of them are philosophical, some of them are practical. I'd like to just point out a couple and then turn it over to Ms. Hupert to get into some finer details. The model has not been used in other states in these settings. Michigan did have an advisory group for the governor and the legislature, but they did not have rulemaking and unilateral authority. The proposal sets up an appointed committee. The committee does not function like other labor negotiations at a labor table where both sides sit down, hammer out an agreement, and then both walk away somewhat satisfied and somewhat dissatisfied, but that's compromise. Minnesota does have a model, in the form of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, that has labor and employers working together, hammering out their differences, and then only if they all agree does it move forward to the legislature and or go to rulemaking. The appointed board has virtually no legislative oversight. Instead, it's the governor's appointee and department folks determining many issues that would typically be negotiated at the bargaining table. While we have many questions on the budgeting and facility payment implications of decisions of the board, we assume that will be covered in the Health and Human Services Committee, just as we assume Civil Law Committee will address other civil action questions. I would again like to thank the author for having met with us and continue to meet with us to try to work out some of our differences. I will now turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Hupert, for some more specific issues of concern.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erin Hupert. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Leading Age Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. To pick things up from my colleague, we are still reviewing the DE2 that you adopted, so I will draw attention to a few concerns by section, again acknowledging that it's not exhaustive. Section 4 in the definitions, Subdivision 7 defines nursing home employer. That current definition we feel is broad and could impact non-licensed certified businesses who have employees who also work in a nursing home. Subdivision 8, definition of nursing home worker, again, concerned that it may be overly broad. We're not sure how this definition handles ancillary staff like therapists, lab technicians, medical staff like medical directors or physicians, supplemental nursing staff and their employers. Section 5, establishment of the board, as mentioned by my colleague under this rubric, simple majority rules with potentially inequitable interests around the table, whereas at a bargaining table, even under the process established by the WCAC, which is also operated within DALI, there are equal members of labor and management as well as legislative appointees, so that the legislature has oversight and eyes into what is happening at that WCAC table. Section 6, duties of the board. I would point out that it requires the board to adopt rules no later than August 1st of 2024 and requires the use of data, including current wage and benefit data. For those of you who have the pleasure of serving on Health and Human Services, you know that there is a two-year lag between data submitted to DHS and then what is approved for a payment rate. So we're wondering which version of data would be used under this particular model. In Subdivision 4, it appears to preempt the board's rules with other agencies, so we are already subject to rules and regulations by OSHA, DALI, MDH, DHS. Those are designed to protect the health and safety of seniors as well as workers. So if you look at page 5, line 24, it appears to add occupational health and safety standards under the board's purview. We're not sure how that is reconciled by those already established by DALI and OSHA. Again, these are just a couple of examples. In Section 7, which outlines the training of workers, Subdivision 6 requires nursing home employers to provide proof that to DALI that every 6 months each of the nursing home workers has completed their training. We have a couple of logistical questions about how that would work. It is one thing to make sure that employees are aware of training, provide them access to training, and even compensate them for that hour of training. It is a different thing to make sure that they take it every 6 months. Sometimes, for a variety of reasons, employees are just not able to take or don't have interest in taking a training. I will personally say that I am very much behind in taking my obligatory IT compliance training. It happens on occasion. Related to the training component, the contact information and privacy of the employee appears to be an opt-out rather than an opt-in. So, in other words, an employee must actively seek to protect their privacy and opt out of having their information shared. The compensation for travel under Subdivision 7 is probably more for DHS, but we do have questions about how those expenses would be reflected under 256R. As my colleague stated in the beginning, we have some pretty serious concerns about the bill as presented. Chief among them, that nothing in this legislation improves wages, which requires legislative action. By contrast, House File 733, which has bipartisan support and was heard in Human Services a couple weeks ago in the House, would actually facilitate those wage increases. We remain willing to engage in the conversation with proponents and with the bill sponsor to refine this proposal as it moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hupert. Questions? Representative Daniels.
I have a question for Toby Pearson. When I started in 2015, we had the newly formed aging committee, and we got to talk quite a few times. but I can't remember. I know we did a sizable increase to the nursing homes for funding, and I have a number in my head, but I'm not sure it's right. Do you happen to remember what the increase was?
Well, I think what you're referring to,
and that's kind of out of the purview of this committee, but go ahead and answer.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you're referring to the value-based reimbursement system that was implemented in 2017. There wasn't an exact amount. Instead, it was a newer way to recognize costs and pay facilities for costs. Prior to that, nursing homes, assisted living, elderly waiver would have to come in and ask for a percent increase every year, oftentimes with our union friends saying we need X percent, and then the legislature, unfortunately, would typically give us X minus percent, and then we'd go home with less than what we asked for. But I think that's what you're referring to.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the latitude. My memory is it was a good chunk of increase, and I remember going back to my local nursing homes, and they were so thankful the increase was, they could use it for wage increases, they could use it for roofing repairs, they could use it for maintenance, equipment. And it was, a nice size. I remember that was something you felt good about doing. And then I've got a comment, not pointed towards you, but I thought maybe we could help with the numbers. We just, and I'm also on the Children and Families Committee, and we have passed out free meals for all, and that's going to add a lot of dollars to the budget. And some of it's federal reimbursed, some of it's not. But anyway, I just wanted from your perspective, Mr. Pearson, if that kind of money would help with your increase and with your needs, that if we could put that money into your nursing homes, would that be beneficial?
And again, that's not in the purview of this committee, but Mr. Pearson, if you can quickly answer, and I don't like pitting one group of people against another, but Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, House File 733 that we referenced is a $52 a day add-on that is directed to nursing home workers' wages and benefits. We haven't received a fiscal note on that, but it's somewhere near probably about $1 billion over 4 years. So that's what we're asking. We've guessed that would be about $4 an hour increase for folks that would be working, so that would take us from about 17 up to closer to $20-$21 an hour for a lot of folks that are working.
Representative Schultz, that's on my list. Looks sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Abaje. I appreciate your stated intent at the beginning of this presentation, and I just worry that this might be something that doesn't get to your stated intent. And I wanted to ask, frankly, kind of a qualifying question, like, why would this standard, or why is the standards boards necessary, and who's asking for it to the tune of increasing wages for our caregivers?
Representative Abaji.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. So again, going to the purpose of this bill, it is really to ensure that we have an arena where employers, employees, and the agencies that oversee nursing homes have an opportunity to work together to understand the conditions, and that can include wages. Not every board decision will necessarily accommodate wages, but those are under their purview, to ensure that the highest standards are being met in nursing homes. And we want to make sure that our workers are, at the highest standards that they can be, and same with our employers. Wages do come into that. And so this will be a place for them and an opportunity for them to have that discussion about what the wages are, and in a way that also holds accountable the employers who are receiving funding from both the state and federal government to ensure that funding is being used in a manner that supports ensuring that we have the highest standards in our nursing homes.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and Representative Abaje. I hear you, and I appreciate what you're saying here. My concern here is that currently that responsibility and that power is here at the legislature. And for me, last Friday, I went to visit the nursing home in my district, and I got to hear directly from the workers in the nursing home. There was about a dozen, and they had the chance to talk to their legislator. And frankly, I think I might be more accessible than this board for the future of workers here in Minnesota. So that's my concern with this bill, and I'm not going to take up any further time, but just simply taking this responsibility away from us sitting around this table and putting it into the hands of a board is something concerning for me.
Representative Baji.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I take that as well, you know, to be accessible to our constituents and our members. I think that's very important. I think one of the things, though, that this board does is it does ensure that workers across the industry have a voice, have an opportunity to ensure that they're heard about what their conditions are, rather than kind of that one-on-one interaction. And so I'm hopeful that as we continue to have conversations about this bill and as we continue to refine it, that will become clear.
Any further questions? If not, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you're obviously familiar with the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council.
Yes, I am. I served on it for a period.
Pretty important council, wouldn't you say?
It was set up, and it was my understanding, Representative McDonald, it was set up to take those issues that attended to, depending on which side of the aisle you were on, were hit back and forth between, and they either improved or weakened workers' protections, and they set this up so that labor and management could get together and talk about these issues and move them forward and come to an agreement on issues that they both could work with. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative can you please help me?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, it is pronounced Agbadjay. Agbadjay.
I said it right in my head, but it couldn't come out that way.
No problem.
Thank you, Representative. Yes. So the Workman's Compensatory Advisory Council is very important for labor and management employees and employers. And it's a board that comes together and works out all the problems and comes up with great solutions and brings it back to the legislature and gives it us the authority to vote upon. With your board, it circumvents the legislature completely, 100%. And for that, it gives us lawmakers no authority whatsoever going forward. And it really doesn't get to the crux of the issue, which is funding for our nursing homes. So do you believe that your bill will help some of our rural nursing homes that are on the verge of closing their doors because of lack of funding? Your bill costs a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars in the future. That money, don't you think, would be better spent in funding, fully funding our workers who are taking care of the most vulnerable and the elderly?
Representative Abaji.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative McDonald, for that question. I think that's right. We do need to fund our nursing homes. We do need to fund the sectors of our society that need the most help. What we also need to do is we also need to ensure that the people who are working in those places have that voice in that space. And so what this bill does is it creates this board. They work with their regulators. They work with their employers. And the workers also have that opportunity to bring in a true worker perspective. And so that's what we're getting at with this board, to ensure that what we're hearing from workers and what we're hearing from industry and what we're hearing from regulators can all work together to ensure that the highest standards are being met. I think one of the issues, I think, when it comes down to it is, like, we will have to, you know, make a decision about, you know, how funding is spent. I think a number of committees are discussing that now and where that goes. But one of the things that this bill wants to do is ensure that the people who are most affected by the amount of money that's going to be coming to our nursing homes have a say in the accountability of that funding.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I do ask for a roll call on the vote. And then just
all being asked for, there'll be a roll call.
Thank you. Just a thought, Representative, that hearing from the leading age Minnesota, the long-term care initiatives, imperatives, and the care providers who work in this industry for many years, long before I was here and long before you were here, shared their concerns. And we as lawmakers come up with a law, we think we know best. I have a guilty of that as well. Bring in a DE2 amendment at the last minute on the first stop, giving the public and those who care about this issue, including you, Representative, and who have worked on it for years, no opportunity to read the amendment and then have to testify. I would assume that we both sides do it. I think, Mr. Chair, that practice has to end. It's not fair to the representatives, and it's certainly not fair to the constituents and those who are work so hard on the issues, to bring an amendment in with no warning whatsoever, no opportunity to read it. So, Mr. Chair, I think that practice, really, we have to do a better job. And I hope the other side's listening, that we as lawmakers, it's not fair to the public. It's not fair for, especially in this bill, with those who are have worked their entire lives in the for the aging and for long-term care and for nursing home, not to have an opportunity to read a bill before it comes to committee, when they already had and were up to snuff on it. Are you aware, Representative, that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, which includes nursing facilities, are pretty much, I think, this April, are going to release a proposed nursing home staffing mandates for Medicare skilled nursing facilities this April?
Representative Bajay and Representative Dahl, if we can get wrapped up here, we need to move on. Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative McDonald. Just to address quickly, the DE2 amendment was posted according to the rules of the 24-hour rule. So I know it's quick, but we did have it up with a day's notice, which is according to the rules. On the question about the staffing conditions that are meant to come out, again, this bill doesn't cover staffing. It would only talk about working conditions and wages, but it wouldn't discuss anything that is pertinent to the residents of the nursing home, because that is covered through the federal government and the state.
Representative McDonald, wrap up and so we can get off.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative, that's not entirely true, or not a fact, because it certainly, this bill would affect both the residents and the workers as well. Just our concerns, it's tough to be in the minority because we always have to be a Debbie Downer and point out areas of concerns of a bill that brought to our attention, which you heard today in testifying, and hopefully bring that to light, that you can take that consideration. Your friends on the other side of the aisle, we are guilty of it. We're in the majority. We're not going to point out any errors and deficiencies publicly, but I just advise you to take note of the concerns of those in the industry. I'm not an expert by any means, but those who have been working in long-term care and the nursing facilities, who you heard need funding for their home care nurse, workers, that's what's important. And I just hope that you take to heart their concerns and perhaps make some amendments to your bill going forward. I think that'll make you a better lawmaker. I think it'll make our workers who take care of these loved ones better workers, and with more certainty and sustainability for our nursing homes. So with that, Mr. Chair, I wrap up my conclusion.
Thank you, sir. Representative Bajay, I think I heard you talking that you've been working well with the people and moving forward. And I trust that you'll continue to work with the people that have concerns about the bill. And with that, do you want to do a quick wrap-up, and then we'll get to a vote?
Sure, not to take too much time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I appreciate all the concerns that have been aired today. I will just say, as I do my work, I continue to work with those who may have different ideas about the bill than I do. And sometimes they come up with something that's actually really useful. And so I look forward to future conversations with anyone who has concerns or interest in the bill. And I think that that's the best way that we all can work as legislators. So I hope that you guys will continue to support this bill as it moves through the committees. And should you have any questions or concerns, my door is open.
And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 908, as amended, be referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. And clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Vice Chair Berg?
Aye.
Berg, aye. Lead McDonald?
Nay.
McDonald, nay. Representative Daniels?
Nay.
Daniels, nay. Representative Greenman is excused. Representative Hill?
Aye.
Hill, aye. Representative Hussein?
Aye.
Hussein, aye. Representative Jordan?
Jordan, aye.
Jordan, aye. Representative Koslowski?
Aye.
Koslowski, aye. Representative Meckland?
Nay.
Meckland, nay. Representative Myers?
Nay.
Myers, nay. Representative Schultz?
Nay.
Schultz, nay. Representative Wolgamott?
Aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Mr. Chair, with the conclusion of roll call, we have 7 ayes and 5 nays.
With 7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way to Human Services. Thank you, Representative Bajay. And members, we will not be meeting on Thursday, as we all have been told at session this morning.
intent is to move that agenda for that was before this Thursday to next Thursday, and go forward from there. And with that, members, if there are no more questions, we are adjourned.
You're going to get more. Oh, I